You're listening to Keeping Up. We're doing cardiology articles again this month, and Dr. Corey Slovis and I will be taking a look at the cardiology literature as it relates to emergency medicine this month. It is a lot of fun, and here are some highlights of what you're going to hear as you move through this recording. For those of you who can't remember what the TIMI risk score is, I've set it to music. It goes like this. 7 days, no aspirin, 65 or less, 50% lesion. Negative labs, less than 3 risks, less than 2 events of pain, and a negative ECG. Yes, believe it or not, I did just actually sing the TIMI risk score to the tune of the 12 Days of Christmas.
Let me say at the outset, no matter what a patient comes in for, I get a troponin on them. They come in, they have an earache, troponin. It's how I stratify everyone now. You should get a troponin in heart failure. You should not use morphine in congestive heart failure. There's not one good study, or even a bad study, to show any benefit.
This trial was called the 3-CPO, which stands for 3 Interventions in Cardiogenic Pulmonary Oedema, sort of that British spelling of edema. This is almost a cool acronym, 3-CPO. It's sort of like the Star Wars backwards kind of thing. I think they're going to do the 2RD2, the Bakuchu, Solo, Han, and Walker Sky trials coming up.
Well, it is interesting. If you look at the methodology, they actually did have robots place the respiratory devices on the patients. You know, I think when you hear a history and someone has atypical chest pain, they're going to die. Because typical chest pain doesn't get sent home, atypical does.
That's right.
The old EKG is your friend, too. I know lead one is your friend, and Dr. Wren is my friend, although he doesn't admit it sometimes. But the old EKG is your friend.
Cocaine trails marijuana slightly in the drug abuse polls across the United States. It's the second most common drug of abuse, but it leads to the most ED visits. I think that's because most marijuana users are going to the convenience stores for chips, and when they come to the ED, we keep them NPO.
When I hear cocaine, my thought is Valium, Valium, Valium.
Put ondansetron in the water fountain in your PZD. We give Tylenol to febrile patients in triage. Man, why not give them some ondansetron if they're puking? We need to be giving this drug. It doesn't sedate kids. And unlike Phenergan, it doesn't kill kids less than 2. Anecdotally, I've got 6 kids. Motrin seems to bring them back from the dead. It always seemed to work better and faster than acetaminophen, so my fatherly hunch has been confirmed with ironclad, evidence-based medicine now.
This cold, I really tried not getting it. I washed my hands after every patient, but I think somebody infected the keyboard and I just didn't alcohol wipe enough after typing on that damn keyboard.
Welcome to Keeping Up. Our mission at Keeping Up is to help you as emergency physicians to keep up with cutting-edge literature in order to bring current research to bear on your clinical practice and to do it on your time schedule. We bring you a monthly digital recording reviewing the top 10 articles from the past year focused on a specific clinical domain in emergency medicine. These recordings are structured to be high yield, and each one gives you the historical backdrop so you know how this article fits into core EM knowledge. It gives you the ABIM board relevance of the article or what's being presented. The results of the article are then concisely presented. It's not meant to be a journal club. The application to your day-to-day practice is next. We tell you how this article will change what you do on your next shift, and we have a lot of fun on the way as well. So this month, we're presenting the top 10 cardiology articles from the past 12 months. Now, actually, since cardiology is so broad, we decided to do 20 articles. Last month, we recorded with Dr. David Marin, and we did 10. And this month, we were with Dr. Corey Slovis, and we're going to record 10 more. So we've worked hard to do the searching for you and have handpicked these articles from over 60 journals to bring you the very best, most relevant articles to keep you up with emergency medicine literature. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, enjoy, and start keeping up with emergency medicine literature. We have Dr. Slovis here today. He is the chairman of the department. And so without further ado, we'll get started.
Well, let me apologize first. Always a great way to start. Let me apologize to you, Clay, and to our listeners. This cold, I really tried not getting it. I washed my hands after every patient, but I think somebody infected the keyboard and I just didn't alcohol wipe enough after typing on that damn keyboard. So the first article I wanted to do was facilitated PCI in patients with ST elevation myocardial infarction. And this is from the New England Journal of Medicine. It's by Ellis and colleagues, and these are a group of the FINESSE investigators. And the background here is that lytics can be given quickly. PCI may take a little while. And so what these investigators wanted to do was to see via a multi-center international double-blind placebo-controlled trial, I mean a state-of-the-art trial, whether PCI directly was as good as a priming dose of either half-dose RPA, Retivace, combined with epcipsimab, which is hard to say but is Riopro in real life, or just PCI preceded by Riopro alone. So there are three groups. Patients get primary PCI, patients get PCI preceded by half-dose RPA and Riopro, or PCI preceded by Riopro alone. They went ahead and gave the RPA or Retivace as 2 5-milligram doses 30 minutes apart, which is half of the usual 10-milligram doses 30 minutes apart. I was excited by this. In the past, the ASCEND-4 trial, which looked at facilitated PCI, had been a failure, but using half-dose lytic, maybe this would be better. The results, unfortunately, don't bear this out. It's a large trial. It's 2,452 patients. It's well-controlled. Their median door-to-balloon was 2.2 hours, and the initial data showed that there was better ST segment resolution in the group that got facilitated PCI, either with Riopro and RPA or just Riopro alone, except the bottom line was that when they looked at the real endpoints, death, shock, repeat MI, or a composite of all three, there was no benefit, and that primary PCI was as good as these priming doses. And so I think the take-home on this is, although theoretically facilitated PCI, pretreatment with either lytics or a 2B3A or both, ought to work, it doesn't seem to be effective. There's going to be more trials. This one used 2 doses of RPA. What about if we just gave 1 dose? And so at the present time, we need to follow the current ACC-AHA guidelines of either lytic or lab, but not combining both.
Yeah, it seems like not only did the RPA not help, it actually hurt some patients and caused more bleeding.
Yeah, there was some more bleeding. It wasn't dramatic, but there was more bleeding. We just keep waiting for the magic bullet that's going to enhance PCI. This study says this format is not it.
Yeah, it seems like our energies would be better focused on door-to-balloon.
Door-to-balloon or, you know, ambulance-to-balloon.
Yeah.
Or ultimately, it's going to be having more patients come to the hospital sooner, dial 911 sooner.
All right, the next article is by Chang et al., Actual Financial Comparison of 4 Strategies to Evaluate Patients with Potential Acute Coronary Syndromes. This was in Academic Emergency Medicine in July of 2008. The historical backdrop, computed tomographic coronary angiogram, or CTA for short, is a rapid, non-invasive way to detect coronary stenoses. It's really come of age over the past few years as CT technologies advanced and multi-row detectors have become standard. You know, CTA has advantages of rapidity, convenience, its non-invasive nature, and a pretty high negative predictive value, 95 to 100%. The disadvantages are pretty obvious. It's a lot of ionizing radiation. It's upwards of 10 millisieverts to the chest. You also get exposure to IV contrast, and occasionally you get technically poor quality studies that can't be interpreted. And you also have to carefully select your patients. They need to be low prop, no coronary disease history, and in some machines, you have to have a low heart rate to obtain your images properly. CTA is also costly. These authors sought to determine whether or not the use of immediate CTA without biomarkers would be more cost-effective than admitting to an OBS unit and getting biomarkers followed by CTA. So what they did is they had 4 groups. They had an immediate CTA group. They got a quick H&P, a creatinine, and without biomarkers, went straight to the scanner. The next group got a set of biomarkers, a couple of sets of biomarkers, and then had CTA. The next group was sort of the more usual, where you get a couple sets of biomarkers, and then they get a routine stress test. And the final group was just admitted to the team and whatever the team wanted to do. So this was a retrospective study of patients at one hospital. They were non-randomly assigned by their treating physicians to one of these four groups: immediate CTA, OBS biomarker CTA, OBS biomarker stress test, or admission for a formal, quote, rule-out MI to a hospitalist.
For those of you who can't remember what the TIMI risk score is, I've set it to music, you know, thinking of the holidays approaching in the next couple of months, and set it to the 12 days of Christmas. It goes like this: 7 days, no aspirin, 65 or less, 50% lesion, negative labs, less than 3 risks, less than 2 events of pain, and a negative ECG. Yes, believe it or not, I did just actually sing the TIMI risk score to the tune of the 12 days of Christmas. The TIMI risk score: you get a 0 if you have not had aspirin in the last 7 days, if you're 65 or less, if you have prior caths with no stenoses greater than 50%, if you have negative cardiac biomarkers, if you have less than 3 cardiac risk factors, and if you have had less than 2 anginal type events in the past 24 hours, and finally, if you have a negative electrocardiogram. So there you go, the TIMI risk score.
Well, on to the results. Patients were included if they had a TIMI risk score of 0 to 2, and the treating physician was planning to admit. Now, there were far fewer immediate CTA patients, so they randomly chose an equal number of matched patients from the other three groups as controls. Patients were excluded from the CTA groups, surprised, if they had contraindications to getting a CTA. They followed all these patients through their hospital stay and for 30 days and watched out for death, MI, revascularization, because they wanted to monitor for safety of each strategy, but the primary endpoint was the cost of each strategy. They ended up with a total number of patients, 643. They were distributed between the four groups. All the patients in the first three groups ended up with diagnostic testing, either a CTA or a stress test. Now, this was surprising. Only 21% of the patients admitted to a hospitalist for routine rule-out MI ended up having diagnostic testing. That's pretty low. Bottom line is the immediate CTA group had the lowest median total facility cost and length of stay. The immediate CTA group had a median cost of $1,200 and a stay of 8 hours. The other groups had costs and lengths of stay 2 to 4 times as much and as long. If you were in the observation biomarker CTA group, $2,300, 21 hours. The OBS stress test group, $4,000, 26 hours. And the usual admit to a hospitalist group, almost $3,000 and 30 hours. And it was also found to be as safe as the other groups with the composite outcomes that they looked at. The, quote, usual care group actually had a higher readmission rate, no doubt because they weren't doing any kind of objective testing on these people. The application to your practice: the authors warn that large prospective studies need to be done before this strategy can be fully adopted. You know, I think CTA is a helpful tool if it's done on the right patients: young, no coronary disease, low risk. And obviously the pros and cons need to be weighed. Pros of cost, safety, rapidity, convenience, accuracy. The cons: radiation, although it's pretty much the same as getting a stress test, IV contrast, and the need to select patients and to slow their heart rate down if you don't have a double source CT scanner. I'd say know the protocols at your institution. I don't recommend an immediate CTA strategy yet, but I think the day is coming when a patient's going to come in, get a quick risk stratifying H&P, EKG, bedside creatinine, CTA, and discharge paperwork in a matter of a few hours. I think that's where we're headed.
Well, Clay, I hope that's where we're headed. There are a couple of things here. Number one, how can you admit someone to the hospital for rule-out ischemia and not do an objective test? You're just saying, come back because we're going to charge you again, and then you'll get an objective
test. Yeah, it's amazing.
The other thing is, I'm worried about CTA. I think it's being applied to very high-risk groups, and we're seeing that in the high-risk group of elderly patients, it's going to miss 5 to 10% of lesions. There's a recent article that I know is going to get reviewed suggesting that CTA misses up to 10% of lesions. Having said that, in low-risk people, that aren't going to be able to run rapidly on a treadmill, as long as you have the right CT reader, it is a great test and has huge potential because it has a negative predictive value approaching 100% in lower risk patients. Well, my next article is Cardiac Troponin and Outcome in Acute Heart Failure. This appears in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's by Frank Peacock and his colleagues from the ADHERE investigators. Let me say at the outset, no matter what a patient comes in for, I get a troponin on them. They come in, they have an earache, troponin, it's how I stratify everyone now. But all kidding aside, troponin is either the enzymatic assay biomarker of choice, or at least it's done with CKMB to determine whether someone's either having a myocardial infarction or to see whether they're at high risk with unstable angina, as up to one-third of unstable angina patients are going to have an elevated troponin. This study looks at troponin not in ischemia, but in heart failure patients. The ADHERE registry has looked at heart failure patients, has a large data set, and they've previously shown that three objective measures, systolic blood pressure less than 115 millimeters, BUN greater than 43, or creatinine above 2.75, all predict badness. And in fact, if all three are positive, patients are going to have a mortality of about 22% or higher.
Ouch.
What they did in a large cohort group from their ADHERE heart failure database is they looked at patients who had troponins and looked to see whether troponin was an independent risk factor for poor outcome. And the importance here is, if it is, then if you have a troponin-positive patient, regardless of their systolic blood pressure, BUN, or creatinine, that's someone that needs to come in and not just observed for short stay or even discharged. They made sure these patients had creatinines less than 2, all had heart failure, and they looked at about 67,000 patients, actually close to 68,000 patients. 6.2% of their patients had a positive troponin. And when they looked at what a positive troponin equated to, these patients had more cardiac procedures, a significantly higher length of stay, and higher mortality. And what the authors conclude, and the take-home of this article is, a positive troponin in a patient with heart failure is an independent risk factor for increased morbidity and mortality. These are patients to be admitted and not to a short stay area. They're going to stay longer, they're going to do worse, and they have a higher incidence of death. Beware positive troponins.
You know, I think it's pretty clear from this that we need to be ordering troponin on our heart failure patients, and certainly the ones that are positive need to be monitored more closely, preferably in a CCU-type setting.
Either a CCU or step down. And, you know, it's always bad to advocate more testing, but troponin is an assay in heart failure that ought to get done.
You know, also from this ADHERE registry and also by Dr. Peacock that recently came out in EMJ Online was looking at morphine and its association with increased mortality and acute decompensated heart failure. 14% of the patients in the registry received morphine. The ones that did had higher dyspnea at rest, more congestion on chest x-ray, rouse on exam, and more had elevated troponin. The patients that got morphine were more likely to need mechanical ventilation, they stayed longer in the hospital total, they stayed longer in the ICU, and they got more vasodilators and inotropes. And even after adjustment for the known risks for mortality, the ones that you mentioned including an elevated troponin, and exclusion of ventilated patients, morphine was still an independent risk factor for mortality. So the ADHERE registries now come up with at least two independent predictors of mortality, troponin and morphine use. Certainly one of these is a modifiable risk factor. I mean, you can't change if you've got a bumped troponin, but you can change if you get morphine.
You should get a troponin in heart failure. You should not use morphine in congestive heart failure. There's not one good study, or even a bad study, to show any benefit. Many of us, including myself, have used it. You want to give a couple of milligrams, one or two. It decreases anxiety. It's a vasodilator. But based on the retrospective study you've just mentioned, not prospective, but retrospective, morphine is dangerous, and not my bias, but my teaching has changed.
Yeah.
Rather than saying, well, you could give a little, We've pulled morphine off of our EMS units for congestive heart failure. We do not advocate its use in the emergency department for heart failure. For pain, most excellent. For heart failure, just say no.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you can't prove causality with a retrospective study, but I mean, this is pretty compelling data, and I mean, it's a practice changer for me.
Agree.
Along the heart failure theme, this is by Gray et al., Non-Invasive Ventilation in Acute Cardiogenic Pulmonary Edema. This is in the New England Journal of Medicine, July of 2008. Historical backdrop is acute cardiogenic pulmonary edema accounts for 1 million admissions every year, and the inpatient mortality is 10 to 20%. There have been a lot of small case series and subsequent small randomized controlled trials that showed benefit of non-invasive ventilation. That's either CPAP or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, and I'm just going to call that BiPAP, CPAP or BiPAP. And some meta-analyses showed possible mortality benefit for these non-invasive ventilatory strategies. We know that BiPAP improves oxygenation and CO2 clearance better than CPAP based on prior studies as well. Well, this study sought to determine definitively whether CPAP or BiPAP improved short-term survival and whether BiPAP was superior to CPAP. Now, this trial was called the 3-CPO, which stands for 3 Interventions in Cardiogenic Pulmonary Oedema, sort of that British spelling of edema. This is almost a cool acronym, 3-CPO. It's sort of like the Star Wars backwards kind of thing. I think they're going to do the 2RD2, the Bakuchu, Solo, Han, and Walker Sky trials coming up.
Well, it is interesting. If you look at the methodology, they actually did have robots place the respiratory devices on the patients.
So the 3-CPO trial results are this. Patients included were over 18, had a respiratory rate greater than 20, had a PCO or a pH of less than 7.35, and they had pulmonary edema on chest x-ray. People that needed emergency coronary intervention like a PCI were kicked out. They were excluded. Patients got randomized in a 1-to-1-to-1 fashion to standard oxygen, CPAP, or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, BiPAP. There were 1,156 patients that were randomized, and they got spread evenly between the groups. Here's the result. There was no difference in mortality between patients that got standard therapy and non-invasive ventilation, either CPAP or BiPAP. There was also no difference in mortality between the CPAP and BiPAP groups. However, there was significant improvement in dyspnea, heart rate, acidosis, and hypercapnia in those that received non-invasive ventilation, either CPAP or BiPAP, and those who received the standard therapy. So, how does this apply to your practice? I mean, it kind of stinks in the sense that CPAP and BiPAP weren't that great as far as mortality benefit in severe pulmonary edema. But here's what I say. When a patient comes in that's in trouble, throw all the usual medical therapy at them. Nitrates are your friends. And if they look like they're nearing respiratory failure, start them on CPAP or BiPAP. This study would prove that this buys you time. It may allow enough time for the medical therapy to work. At least it's going to give you enough time to talk to the patient and the family and the staff to give you a little time to breathe and get ready to intubate. And if the patient needs intubation, they're going to have improved physiologic status when the time comes. It's going to be safer, smoother, and give you a little less sphincter tone.
Clay, I agree with your recommendations. I just don't know if I fully accept the findings of this article. It's impressive, and it's the largest CPAP-BiPAP pulmonary edema article done, except there are a couple of interesting things here. Only 3% of each group got intubated. That's much less than prior studies, which have shown intubation rates as high as like 32%. And there have been some letters in the New England Journal about this study. They excluded life-saving and emergency intubations. There was no objective criteria for intubation. And then there was a 9.6% mortality rate, which is 3 times as high as the intubation rate. What are these people dying from? And so I'm unsure if this large, well-done trial is as well-done as it looks like. The meta-analyses, the prior studies, everyone showing dramatic effects with CPAP and BiPAP, I'm not ready to say it doesn't decrease mortality. But for sure the take-home is, What it does long-term is unclear. What it does short-term has been shown in every study. Oxygen tensions go up, patients feel better, it buys everybody time prior to intubation if it doesn't avoid intubation.
Absolutely. Use it. Okay, I think you're up next. This is sudden cardiac arrest associated with early repolarization.
It's by a large number of European authors, each with a more indecipherable name. I apologize to our European colleagues for butchering this, but it's by Hasegura and colleagues. Many of the authors are from France, and I don't have any French left in me. This appears in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this is an important article and a somewhat practice-changing article. It has changed my practice. All of us have been taught how to read early repolarization, and I think all of us have been taught it's benign. It's usually seen in young adult or teens. It's usually seen in African Americans more than whites, and it's usually seen more in males than females. It's very common in athletes. Well, what this study did is it went somewhat backwards. They took patients that had already had V-fib arrests and were resuscitated and now had internally inserted pacers, IACDs. And it's from 22 centers from Europe and Canada. And they then said, okay, these people had V-fib arrests. What was the incidence of early repolarization? And has that compared to the general population? They defined early repol as equal to or greater than 0.1 millivolt elevation in the inferior lateral leads. All of these patients had either a little bit of a QRS notch or a little bit of slurring. And then they took 412 normal patients. When they compared them, they saw that in the V-fib group, the patients that had already arrested once and hopefully weren't going to arrest again, that early repol was seen in 31%. Almost one-third of the patients had early repol on their pre-V-fib arrest EKG or on their baseline EKG once their IACD had been inserted. When they looked at the control group, only 5%, a very statistically significant difference, 5% versus 31%. Of interest, when they went back into the charts of the patients that had the cardiac arrests, there was a higher incidence of prior syncope, and there was a higher incidence of V-fib arrests during sleep. What this article says to me is if you see an EKG and it has early repol on it, it's usually benign. But if you see it in a patient that's come in with syncope or presyncope, that's a patient that I no longer say, EKG is normal, just has early repol. That's now a patient that I say, syncope, near syncope, early repol. You know, before you leave, I'd like our cardiologist to just take a brief look at you. I'm sure there's nothing wrong, but I'd just like to be positive.
I think that I would love to say benign early repol is still benign. But this study really makes me question that now. You know, one thing is it didn't have a large number of athletes or African Americans, like you said, which makes it a little less generalizable. And a lot of prior studies have shown that early repol changes are so common. It seems, though, that in patients with syncope, we have to take this seriously. I'm not sure what to do with all the other early repol EKGs I get. I mean, one thing's for sure, we can't refer them all to cardiology. But I think in the setting of syncope, now we have to take it seriously.
I think more is going to come out on this, and I think now that it's made the headlines, more people will be looking at it. There's probably some genetic factors. There's probably some specific ECG patterns that are worse. But at the present time, I just don't want to send out a young, in quotes, healthy patient with benign early repol and then have one of our attorneys say, do you remember the patient you saw last month? I just don't want that conversation. And if I have to inconvenience our cardiologists because the patient has been symptomatic, I think that's the key.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes. And I also want to say that our EP folks, our electrophysiologists, agree with this change in protocol.
Next up, Lynn et al. Predictive value of T-wave abnormalities at the time of emergency department presentation in patients with potential acute coronary syndromes. This was in Academic Emergency Medicine, June of 2008. The historical backdrop, you know, we always say, quote, non-specific ST or T-wave changes and assume that these really don't have a lot of significance as an independent predictor of
coronary disease. And this study would challenge that assumption. Now, we all know that ST depression and ST elevation are bad. These EKG changes get our attention. But what about patients that just have flat T waves or a little bit inverted T waves? Does this mean anything, especially if it's not dynamic? Well, that's what this study sought to find out. I'd say as far as relevance for your boards, you need to know your acute MI patterns on ECG cold and know that dynamic ST or T wave changes are very concerning for active ischemia. On to the results of the study. This was a secondary analysis of patients presenting with symptoms concerning for acute coronary syndrome. Now, they were excluded if they had prior MI, Q waves, a bundle branch block, or any ST deviation. The main outcome measure was a composite of death, acute MI, revascularization, coronary stenosis greater than 50% on cath, or a stress test with reversible ischemia at 30 days. They stratified these T-wave changes into different groups. Flat, the next group 1 to 5 millimeter of inversion of the T-wave, or greater than 5 millimeters of inversion. There were 5,582 patients, and 75% of those had no T-wave abnormalities. So, of the remaining, 721, or 13%, have had flat T-waves. 659, or 12%, had the 1 to 5 millimeter T-wave inversion. And only 36 patients, that's less than 1%, had greater than 5 millimeters of T-wave inversion. The results were, it turns out that T-waves really do correlate as an independent predictor of this composite outcome. The composite outcome was met in 8.2 versus 5.7% of patients that had flat T-waves. That's a relative risk of 1.4. But if you had 1 to 5 millimeter T-wave inversion, 13.2 versus 5.7% ended up with the composite outcome. That's a relative risk of 2.4. And get this, in that small number of patients that had greater than 5 millimeters of T-wave inversion, 19.4% versus 5.7%, relative risk of 3.4 ended up with the composite outcome. So if a patient presents with symptoms of ACS, T-wave flattening or inversion, I don't think we can say this is a non-specific EKG change anymore. It might be non-diagnostic, but I don't think we can say non-specific because it did correlate with an increase in 30-day composite cardiac outcomes. So I think the take-home for your next shift is pay attention to T-waves in these patients with chest pain.
For sure. You know, I think when you hear a history and someone has atypical chest pain, they're going to die. Because typical chest pain doesn't get sent home, atypical does.
That's right.
Now, on the EKG, a really bad EKG is non-specific. I wasn't really impressed by it. If you have atypical chest pain and a non-specific ECG or non-diagnostic ECG, you ought to just call the funeral home. And in all seriousness, I think what we need to do is histories need to be viewed on a continuum. And that atypical chest pain can be an MI. Someone who has an atypically abnormal ECG, that is, they don't have ST elevation, that doesn't mean they're not having ischemia or maybe even infarcting. Just they have a non-Q wave infarct. The worse your EKG is from normal, the more likely you are to have something bad. And I like what you said. Maybe non-specific is a bad word. Non-diagnostic, a better word. Mm-hmm. I think all this says is when the EKG gets abnormal, your antenna have got to go up.
Yeah, you better be doing an objective test on these people. You have to.
And I hate to preach, but I think even a normal EKG means an objective test. It may modify the objective test you do. You got a young, healthy person, run them like a dog on the treadmill. Or you have a woman who has maybe a flip T wave but has an atypical history, then a stress echo. But I think the more times we do an objective test, the less times we're going to make a mistake.
That's right. I mean, even people with a TIMI risk score of 0 to 1 have 5% chance of having a bad cardiac outcome. So
we TIMI 0, 2 to 4% chance of having an ischemic event. My next article, which also appears in the New England Journal, is by Ballarudin during primary PCI and acute myocardial infarction. This is from the Horizons AMI trial investigators led by Greg Stone. And the background here is, it used to be that the only agent we gave as far as an antithrombin agent was unfractionated heparin. Then we added low molecular weight heparin. Now there is direct 10A inhibitors and direct 2A inhibitors. And what bivalirudin is, also called Angiomax brand name, is it blocks factor 2 activation. It's a direct thrombin inhibitor. And the Horizons MI study group went ahead and took about 3,600 STEMI patients. These were acute STEMIs all under 12 hours, and they were all were going on to PCI. And they compared two drug regimens, heparin plus a 2B3A inhibitor, and they used Riopro here, versus bivalirudin alone. And what they were looking at were major bleeding and then major adverse clinical events, including death, stroke, and re-MI. And finally, they looked at how often patients needed to go on to emergency revascularization. Only about 5 to 10% of the group got clopidogrel, got Plavix. But this is a nicely designed study. It's fairly direct, two study groups. And the less complicated single drug, bivalirudin, was better. Bivalirudin alone significantly decreased major bleeding and decreased cardiac deaths as compared to heparin and a 2B3A agent. This is a nice study because it allows us to just give one drug and get better results. And I think this is a practice-changing article as long as your cardiologist, as long as your cath lab agrees. But this is something coming down the road. We as ED docs and docettes need to know more than just heparin versus low molecular weight heparin. This direct thrombin inhibitor is going to be used more and more for both STEMI patients and for also people going upstairs.
You know, it definitely was safer and had fewer adverse events as compared with unfractionated heparin and the glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitor. But the main difference was in less bleeding. I mean, I think this direct thrombin inhibitor has a lot of promise. The editorial reminds us, though, that unfractionated heparin was given in a lot of the bivalirudin patients, and true monotherapy with only bivalirudin was only done in 650 patients. There was also an increased incidence of in-stent thrombosis that occurred more frequently in the bivalirudin group. You know, our cardiologists are moving toward this drug. I think that practice is going to change on the basis of it, but I'm just a little hesitant.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think it's our decision to make. But as I looked at cardiac deaths, there was 1.8% death rate with bivalirudin versus 2.9% with heparin and a 2B3A. The in-stent stenosis is a problem. There are some people that are touching them with a little bit of heparin too. We'll see.
You know, there's another bivalirudin article that came out in August in New England Journal and compared bivalirudin versus unfractionated heparin in patients that had unstable angina and negative biomarkers. And they ended up being the same, except that the heparin had a higher bleeding risk. But you know, in that article, they gave 140 units per kilo of heparin. So, I mean, I think that who's loading with that much heparin? Of course it had more bleeding, anyway.
Well, one of the beauties of cardiology is they take every drug, study it as compared to every other drug, and at the end of the day, there's 600 articles. I think this one is going to result in some change. We'll see.
It definitely has potential in patients that are really high risk for bleeding because you certainly get less adverse event of bleeding with bivalirudin. Left bundle branch block, look out. Electrocardiographic criteria for detecting acute MI in patients with left bundle branch block. A meta-analysis done by Tabas et al. In Annals of Emergency Medicine, very current, October of 2008. The historical backdrop, now a diagnosis of acute MI is a lot more difficult if the EKG has left bundle branch block. In 1996, Scarbosa and colleagues published a derived and validated scoring system to detect acute MI in patients enrolled in the GUSTO 1 trial who had left bundle branch block, and they compared this with patients who were not having an acute MI who had a left bundle branch block. Now, ordinarily, when you have an electrocardiogram that shows a left bundle branch block, the QRS and the ST segments go in opposite directions, and that so-called discordance is normal in a left bundle. And this forms the basis for Scarbosa's criteria. Now, if you'll look online, I've put a sample left bundle branch block EKG up there for you to see this. The QRS goes down, the ST goes up. QRS goes up, the ST goes down. That's normal if you have a left bundle. So Scarbosa figured out a scoring system, and it consists of this. You get more points as you have different criteria. Number one in the scoring system, if you have an ST elevation greater than or equal to 1 millimeter with concordant QRS, that's 5 points. That's number one. Number two, if you have ST depression greater than or equal to 1 millimeter in leads V1, V2, or V3, that's 3 points. And the third of Scarbosa's criteria, ST elevation greater than 5 millimeters in a lead with discordant QRS. That's complicated. We'll go back over it. Now keep in mind, for Scarbosa's criteria, they measured ST elevation or depression at the J point, not 80 milliseconds after the QRS. For board relevance, you need to know what a normal left bundle branch block looks like. And as Dr. Wren would say, lead one is your friend. In a left bundle branch block, the terminal force, that is the terminal electrical force, will be to the left. Lead one is your friend. The results of this article, it was a meta-analysis of studies that looked at the use of Scarbosa's scoring system and calculated diagnostic indices if the score was greater than 2 or greater than 3. 11 studies were included, and the summary sensitivity for a score greater than or equal to 3 was 20%. But the specificity was 98%, positive likelihood ratio 7.9, negative likelihood ratio 0.8. How does this apply on your next shift? If you have a patient that has left bundle branch block and presents with concern for acute coronary syndrome, activate the lab if this left bundle branch block is new. Now that's not what this article is about, but that's just general. Now, if the EKG has a left bundle branch block and it shows ST elevation greater than 1 millimeter with concordant QRS, activate the lab. If the ECG shows a left bundle branch block with ST depression greater than 1 millimeter in leads V1, V2, or V3, call the lab. The other criterion was less sensitive and specific, namely ST elevation greater than 5 millimeters in a lead with discordant QRS. But if you have a suspicious patient, it's better to activate the lab than to miss acute MI in left bundle branch block. Left bundle is tough. It makes ECG interpretation in acute MI much tougher. But this study says the EKG still has value. Sensitivity is low, so it's not a good screening test. You're going to have to do more tests. But specificity is high. If they have one of Scarbosa's top two changes, activate the lab.
So, you know, EKGs scare some of us, and left bundles and chest pains scare us. My advice is as follows. Number one, you should write down Elena Scarbosa's name, and when you can't figure out what to do, Google that name and you'll see the EKG pattern from her New England Journal article. Because concord and discord and the pictures in there are good. The other thing is, the old EKG is your friend too. I know lead one is your friend and Dr. Wren is my friend, although he doesn't admit it sometimes. But the old EKG is your friend. Try to find the old EKG. When all else fails, I like your advice. If you have someone with chest pain in the left bundle, be more aggressive, not less aggressive. Well, the final article I have is by the EDQMI investigators. And this is by Tricomi and colleagues, and it's Missed Opportunities for Reperfusion Therapy for ST Segment Elevation Myocardial Infarction, Results of the Emergency Department Quality in Myocardial Infarction, EDQMI, Study. It's from the American Heart Journal. Now, the background of this paper is that in 2006, this group published their first paper showing that ED physicians missed up to 8% of ST elevation MIs on EKG. And what this current study does is they look at 2,200 patients with MI who did not have any contraindications for reperfusion, and they look to see of the patients in this study who didn't get reperfusion, why not? And of their original cohort group, this is actually a study of 460 eligible patients. 22% of this group did not get reperfusion therapy. And they say, okay, they didn't get it. We have already shown that. Why? And so they go into the charts, and they see that these people were more likely to be older, Some of them didn't have chest pain, or the physician recognized the ST elevation but said the pain had resolved. They commented that they had intermittent symptoms for more than 12 hours. Others had had the pain continuous for greater than 10 or so hours. There were a couple that had rule out AAA, got a CT, the CT was negative, and then the physician doesn't go back in and say, okay, it's not a AAA, but it's still an MI. And then in some of them, they just missed the EKG. This article and this group has shown that we as emergency department physicians miss MI, and sometimes even though we see the ST elevation, we choose not to provide reperfusion because we don't identify the ST elevation as acute or indicative of an MI that needs therapy. This is a troubling article. Their first article was troubling. My advice is as follows. Number one, read every EKG expertly for MI. And when you're all done reading the EKG, go back in and read specifically, is there any chance there's an anterior MI, lateral MI, inferior MI, RV MI? I know the fifth one is posterior MI. If you miss it, isolated posterior MIs are so rare, I'll give it to you. But we need to be as good as anybody in reading for MIs. We are the people that are charged with diagnosing it.
It seems shocking that STEMI was missed in a third of patients. It is troubling.
In their original study, they missed ST elevation in 8%. In this subset group that didn't get reperfusion, they missed ST segment elevation. You're right, almost a third. I think what I want to say is, this could never happen to me, this could never happen to us, but it's happening all across the country. There's a 1% to 2% miss rate of MIs, and in some EDs, even higher. We have to have as close to a zero miss rate as possible.
You know, ST elevation can be very subtle in the limb leads, so take a second look at those and watch out with left bundle again. And I think importantly in this study, just because the patient lacks chest pain at the moment that you see them, it doesn't mean it can't be a STEMI if they have a concerning EKG.
For sure.
Pay attention. Finally, McCord et al. This is the American Heart Association statement. Management of cocaine-associated chest pain and myocardial infarction. It was in circulation March of 2008. Historical backdrop is cocaine trails marijuana slightly in the drug abuse polls across the United States. It's the second most common drug of abuse, but it leads to the most ED visits. I think that's because most marijuana users are going to the convenience stores for chips, and when they come to the ED, we keep them NPO, so the marijuana users don't come. In 2005, there were nearly 450,000 cocaine-related ED visits, 40% of which were for chest pain. Cocaine increases heart rate, blood pressure, myocardial oxygen demand, and it causes vasoconstriction. That's a bad combination. Cocaine-related myocardial infarction occurs anywhere from 0.7 to 6% of the time in cocaine chest pain patients. Board relevance? I think you need to know that benzodiazepines are useful in the initial management of acute cocaine intoxication with chest pain. They have a centrally acting anxiolytic effect that mimics the effect of what a beta blocker would do. And according to this AHA update, beta blockers are still contraindicated in acutely cocaine intoxicated chest pain patients. I would not personally be swayed by the recent Dottillo et al. Article in Annals in February of 2008. Listen to last month's podcast with Dr. Marin for more information on this, and also read the editorial for that article by Dottillo et al. I'm not ready to start giving beta blockers to chest pain patients. No
beta
way.
Blockers should not be given to acute cocaine chest pain patients. The article you referred to is not an acute cocaine chest pain article. It's patients who got beta blockers for hypertension as inpatients. And then it's pretty good.
Yeah, they happen to have a positive UDS. Now, the results of this study, getting back on track, this is the position statement. It's not really a study. It's the update and AHA scientific statement. What they said about initial diagnostic tests. Know this, for infrequent users of cocaine, the urine drug screen is going to be positive for about 24 to 48 hours. Chronic users, though, may have a positive drug screen for up to 3 weeks. Also, regarding initial diagnostic tests, the ECG is frequently abnormal. It'll often have early repole, or LVH, as the most common changes. And
Some degree of rhabdomyolysis is usually present in cocaine users. So troponin is your preferred biomarker. That kind of wraps up their recommendations regarding initial diagnostic tests. Then they move on and talk about stress tests. Regarding imaging, a nuclear perfusion study during pain is highly sensitive and specific. Low-risk patients should be evaluated with serial ECG and biomarkers, preferably in a chest pain unit. Now, regarding stress testing, the writing committee says, and I quote, "We recommend that stress testing be optional for patients with cocaine-associated chest pain who have had an uneventful 9 to 12 hours of observation. Stress testing can be performed at the time of observation or on an outpatient basis and should be considered depending on cardiac risk factors and ongoing symptoms," end quote. That's what they have to say about stress tests. On to their comments about STEMI. If a patient has an ST elevation on ECG, treat it as a standard STEMI alert and get them to the cath lab. Fewer cocaine users will end up having a culprit lesion, but they still need a trip to the cath lab. And PCI is preferred over fibrinolysis in a cocaine chest pain STEMI. And use clopidogrel and heparin if they're going to the lab. Don't forget those. On to treatment of cocaine-associated chest pain. Start with the usual, aspirin and nitroglycerin. Instead of beta blockers, reach for benzodiazepines. And avoid beta blockers. This is the official AHA position statement. Calcium channel blockers, except for short-acting nifedipine, are not first line, but they may be considered in patients refractory to nitrates and benzos. And with people that have refractory hypertension, you may touch them with a little phentolamine and the usual anticoagulants, unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin, should be used in high-risk patients. Finally, they comment on arrhythmia. Sodium bicarbonate and lidocaine are the drugs of choice for ventricular tachyarrhythmias in the setting of cocaine intoxication. There's no data yet on amiodarone use in this setting. So how does this apply to your practice? This is a concise review. It's available full text, free, online. It's a quick read, and it's really worth your time as an ED doc because we see this so often. And I think a good pearl is the use of an AMPA bicarb in a patient that has cocaine intoxication, chest pain, and goes into VTVF. Cocaine has some sodium channel blocking properties that bicarb may overcome. Here's your bullets. A cocaine pain MIBI is good. Also, if they're low risk, serial EKG and biomarkers, stress testing optional depending on cardiac risk factors per the AHA statement. Also, treat cocaine STEMI like any other STEMI. Next, avoid beta blockers. And when you're treating these people, aspirin, nitroglycerin, benzos, heparin, and clopidogrel if they're high risk. And if they're having an acute MI, they need to go to the cath lab.
Well, I think that really summarizes it nicely, Clay. When I hear cocaine, my thought is Valium, Valium, Valium. The other thing, and I agree very much with what you're saying about the pain MIBI, if you're seeing a decent number of cocaine chest pain patients, the thought of keeping them for 10 or 12 hours with serial ECGs and serial biomarkers is silly. If their pain continues, if they have one set of negative biomarkers or EKGs unchanged, inject them as long as their pain's unchanged, an hour later scan them, and an hour later discharge them. If their pain goes away, saying outpatient testing is optional. When a cocaine patient leaves the ED, they ain't coming back until they use their cocaine again and have chest pain. So if their pain goes away and their EKG is not ischemic in nature, I don't have any issue in just discharging them.
We're adding a new segment this month to Keeping Up, and we're going to call it Keeping Update. Since we cover only one clinical domain in emergency medicine each month, and we choose the top 10 articles from the past 12 months in that domain, and we don't revisit that particular topic in EM for another year, we were afraid that you, our listeners, might be worried that important articles were slipping past you. Hence, this new segment's for you. It's going to be a headline news kind of format. And the goal is to make you aware of important articles spanning the entire scope of emergency medicine so you can go to the literature and read them for yourselves. We're not going to give a big summary here, just the highlights. Of course, we'll give you a nutshell summary and our humble opinion as well. So here goes with our first keeping update. You've always heard you have to thrombolyze acute ischemic stroke within 3 hours. Well,
two new studies have come out that may challenge that assertion. In The Lancet in October of 2008, thrombolysis with alteplase 3 to 4.5 hours after acute ischemic stroke. It's the SITS-ISTER observational study. This was an industry-funded observational study, and basically what it shows is it looks like alteplase is probably safe and effective even beyond the 3-hour window. In the same vein, a New England Journal article study came out the month before, in September of 2008, thrombolysis with alteplase 3 to 4.5 hours after acute ischemic stroke. This study intentionally looked at patients in that 3 to 4.5 hour window that had ischemic stroke, and they randomized them to placebo or alteplase. And the alteplase group had a better outcome. More had a modified Rankin score of 0 to 1. They did have more intracranial hemorrhage, just like the prior NINS trial, but the mortality was the same. So it really looks like the 3-hour window may be expanding. So
this study, although I'm sure other people are going to criticize it, I didn't say Jerry Hoffman, but this study extends the window. It opens it wider, longer. And 3 hours has been hard for some patients as they hit the door at 2.5 or 3 hours. This looks like another hour and a half. And so I'm excited by this. I think what this means for our listeners is you've got to call the stroke team even if the 3-hour window is violated. Worst case scenario, they say, sorry, not a candidate, or it's too long. But not calling can get you into trouble.
Next one, diagnosis of blunt intestinal and mesenteric injury in the era of multi-detector CT technology, Journal Trauma, August of 2008. Now, we know CT misses hollow viscous injury. But this article wants to find out, what about multi-detector scanners? They used 16-slice. I mean, we're beyond that now. But what about 16-slice scanners? Are we still missing hollow viscous injury? Well, yeah, we are. 11 out of 57, or 19% of hollow viscous injuries were missed. If your patient's got a tender belly, free fluid on the CT, and no solid organ injury, you better admit them to surgery for observation.
Well, I don't know much about this 16 slice. I mean, I guess that's from one or two decades ago. I fear that saying 64 slice is current. If this goes out a week or two late, we might be up to double that. But this is really a large number of miss. I if you have an abnormality on CT scan and you have a tender belly, you don't send people home no matter what viscous injury is missed.
Sodium bicarb versus sodium chloride for the prevention of contrast medium-induced nephropathy in patients undergoing coronary angiography, a randomized trial. You remember the trial that came out with bicarb. It prevented contrast nephropathy. Well, these authors said, was it really the bicarb or was it just some volume? And so they did a head-to-head, sodium chloride versus sodium bicarb. Used a similar protocol, 3 milliliters per kilo for 1 hour before contrast load and 1.5 mils per kilo for 4 hours thereafter. And the outcome of a 25% decrease in estimated GFR was the same in each group. I think the take-home of this is just give them some fluid before their contrast. If you like bicarb, use bicarb. If you like sodium chloride, use sodium chloride.
We've gotten too cavalier with contrast media, and unless you're dealing with a young, healthy, well-hydrated patient, tanking people up with something is better than not.
Next, the effect of a quantitative resuscitation strategy on mortality in patients with sepsis, a meta-analysis. In Critical Care Medicine, October of 2008, prior studies suggest that early goal-directed therapy works, and this meta-analysis of early goal-directed therapy shows that it works too. So do it. That's all I have to say.
So what does this say? If you're in shock, it's better not to be?
Pretty much. If you're in septic shock, use early goal-directed therapy. It works. Per all the other studies and this meta-analysis. Surprise, surprise. Use of antiemetic agents in acute gastroenteritis. A systematic review and meta-analysis in Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine, September of 2008. Ondansetron is good. It decreased recurrent emesis, the need for IV fluids, and the need for admission. The number needed to treat, 5. My bias is, put ondansetron in the water fountain in your PZD. I'm serious. We give Tylenol to febrile patients in triage. Man, why not give them some ondansetron if they're puking?
Well, there are a lot of hospitals that have resisted this. I mean, you're talking about a drug that used to be $70 to $90 per dose. I recently added this to our EMS service and looked at the cost. 71 cents per dose now that it's generic.
Sweet. We need to be giving this drug. It doesn't sedate kids. And unlike Phenergan, it doesn't kill kids less than two. So ondansetron is good.
The other thing is you need to use new drugs as soon as possible before they develop side effects.
All right, next is follow-up after asymptomatic penetrating thoracic injury. 3 hours is enough. Journal of Trauma, September of 08. 3% of asymptomatic patients that have penetrating chest trauma will develop a delayed pneumothorax. 3%. In this study, 100 patients had penetrating chest trauma. 75% stab, 25% gunshot. Repeat 3-hour chest x-ray detected all delayed pneumothoraces. This is good. What it suggests is get an initial chest x-ray, follow up chest x-ray in 3 hours, and send them home.
I don't understand. You get shot or stabbed and you're asymptomatic? Not a chance.
Hey, these are tough people. I don't know where this study was done. It was
done in a group of gladiators.
Well, it's good. 3-hour chest x-ray instead of the 6. Boot them out quicker. These are probably unwholesome people anyway. Paracetamol plus ibuprofen for the treatment of fever in children, randomized controlled trial. Can you believe it? The Brits have actually done a randomized controlled trial comparing acetaminophen and ibuprofen. Believe it. If you got a combination of acetaminophen and ibuprofen, you had 4.4 hours less fever in a 24-hour period than if you got Tylenol alone. If you get ibuprofen, you had 2.5 hours less fever in a 24-hour period. The time to resolution of fever was the same if you got a combo of acetaminophen, ibuprofen, or if you got ibuprofen alone. That is, your fever resolved in 45 minutes versus 71 minutes for Tylenol. Anecdotally, I've got 6 kids. Motrin seems to bring them back from the dead. It always seemed to work better and faster than acetaminophen, so my fatherly hunch has been confirmed with ironclad evidence-based medicine now.
So, Clay, I haven't read this article. What kind of dosing were they using?
They used 15 per kilo for acetaminophen, I believe, and the 10 milligram per kilogram for ibuprofen.
So does this mean for me I ought to take them both at the usual dose rather than one or the other?
I would just pick one. And the one I would pick, if you don't have any renal dysfunction, is ibuprofen. Pre-hospital termination of resuscitation in cases of refractory out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in JAMA, September of 08. They developed a rule, and it had 4 parts. There was, number 1, no automated external defibrillator used or manual shock applied in the out-of-hospital setting. Number 2, no return of spontaneous circulation in out-of-hospital setting. Number 3, the arrest was not witnessed by a bystander. Number 4, no bystander-administered CPR. If this rule for advanced life support providers was applied, it has 4 criteria. It was 100% specific, and the positive predictive value was 100% for predicting no survival to discharge. This article may prevent some dangerous fetal transports.
So when you look at EMS accidents, paramedics and EMTs have 4 times the death rate of firefighters or policemen. And it's usually the paramedic or EMT in the back of the ambulance, and it's usually a traffic accident, either headed to an emergency or coming back from an emergency. Dead people are dead. And I think as we develop algorithms, and this is from the CARES group, this was led by Art Kellerman in Atlanta, this suggests that people that have been down for a while who have either asystole or EMD, a non-shockable rhythm, who went down at an unknown time because it's unwitnessed, they're not coming back, and they ought to be worked in the field, and if they don't generate a pulse, it's time to stop.
I think it's going to probably save some paramedics' lives. Adrenal suppression following a single dose of etomidate for rapid sequence intubation or induction, a prospective randomized study in Journal Trauma, September of 08. This was done in Chattanooga. It's a small, underpowered study that comes to some pretty firm conclusions on some pretty flimsy data. It has an N of 30. Those who received etomidate had a blunted Cortisone stimulation test, longer ICU stay, got more packed red cells, and had more days on a ventilator compared to those who were induced with fentanyl Versed for their RSI. Now, there's some problems. This is very small. It's one center.
31 patients were excluded for protocol violations. It was non-blinded. And the court stim has really been poo-pooed by the surviving sepsis people as not being that valuable. Additionally, we know that the effects of etomidate on adrenal suppression are brief after a one-dose induction. And to result in such disastrous effects in patients that are receiving it, it's kind of hard to fathom. It's really not what we see happening in our patients. I don't think I'd put away etomidate on the basis of this article. I just wanted to bring it to your attention.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's time that there be a multi-center, blinded trial. Now, it's going to be hard to blind. They're going to have to use two different induction agents. But this is kind of crazy.
Yeah. And it's too small. I mean, you can't change your practice on the basis of this article. Well, we thank you so much for listening to us again for another hour. I hope this has been beneficial for you. Please visit our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and you can download these, put them on your MP3 player, and you can also download a PDF file of our written summaries so that you can refer back to it later, depending on if you're a visual or audio learner. Additionally, you can search the archives, and we hope that you'll tune in next month. Next month, we'll be meeting with Keith Wren, talking about some general medical articles.
Well, it's certainly been my pleasure, and I hope when you do the general medical articles, you review something that teaches me how to cure the common cold.
Yes. And now, for a little legal and CME mumbo-jumbo that we have to take care of. Keeping Up is copyright Vanderbilt University. 2008-2009, all rights reserved. Please don't make copies or change the content in any way. But please do tell your friends about this, because that's the way we're going to spread the word. Don't forget to get your CME credit. You can get that by going to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and follow the links. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine is accredited by the Accreditation Council for CME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine designates this educational activity for a maximum of 1.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Thanks so much for listening to Keeping Up. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we hope you'll listen again and tell your friends. Thanks. Bye.